Good morning. Great to see everyone. We can head on over to Daniel. We'll read the end of chapter 2 to recap, and then let's see, maybe jump into chapter 3, but not right away. Okay, I'm guessing Lorenzo did Hebrews last week while we were at Badlands, so I'm really thankful for him for filling in, but missed you guys a week, so we'll read the end of Daniel chapter 2 here just to recap what we covered a couple weeks ago. If we start in verse 44, it says, "In the days of those kings, the God of heaven will set up a kingdom which will never be destroyed. And that kingdom will not be left for another people. It will crush and put an end to all these kingdoms, but itself will endure forever." There's a lot going on in verse 44. One of the things that makes God's kingdom very different from mankind's kingdoms is that mankind's kingdoms rise and fall, right? Not only was the stone cut out of the mountain without hands, that tells us it is divine, and the divine things are eternal. Right, things of this life are perishable. The things of the heavens are eternal. Verse 44 confirms for us that this is a divine kingdom because he says, God of heaven will set up a kingdom. it will never be destroyed, okay? And that kingdom will not be left for another people. So if you think about the way that the statue had unfolded as we examined it, every kingdom was left for another kingdom, okay? The difference with God's kingdom is that when it comes, okay, it's not going to be replaced by another kingdom, and that will be because it will endure forever. There is no other kingdom in this world that can endure forever unless it's God's kingdom, right? The other thing that we did 2 weeks ago was just kind of did a quick, like, how can we prove that the kingdom has been established, that Jesus established it, okay, when he returned in the form of the Spirit, particularly in Acts 2, and that we're not still waiting for a kingdom to come, okay? So we went through some of those verses, got some group participation. Guys chimed in there. This is clearly talking about the church because it's the only kingdom of God that can endure forever because it's a spiritual kingdom. So, okay. It endures forever, verse 45. "Inasmuch as you saw that the stone was cut out of the mountain without hands, and that it crushed the iron, bronze, clay, silver, gold, the great God has made known to the king what will take place in the future." So the dream is true, and its interpretation is trustworthy. Okay? in large, my faith is really found, it's founded on the Word of God. It's founded on Jesus Christ, and it's really founded on this idea that God in His Bible has given us things that would take place in the future, so that way when they come about, we can examine them and see that they are so. That is a unique feature of God, and that's what proves to us that man alone did not write the Bible, and that it was authored by God Himself. So it doesn't matter if you're, where you're reading. That's a pretty consistent thing in the Old Testament where God says time and time again, okay, this will take place when it comes about. You will know that I alone am God. Okay? So that's why this dream is given. Verse 46, "King Nebuchadnezzar falls on his face and did homage to Daniel and gave orders to present him an offering and fragrant incense. The king answered Daniel and said, 'Surely your God is God of gods and Lord of kings,'" this will be important later, "'and a revealer of mysteries, since you've been able to reveal this mystery.'" Which was cool because then Kendall comes up here and talks about Christ in you, the hope of glory, which is the great mystery of the new covenant, right? God's always been the revealer of mysteries. So, Verse 48, the king promoted Daniel, gave him many great gifts, made him ruler over the whole province of Babylon and chief prefect over all the wise men of Babylon. And Daniel made request of the king, and he appointed Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego over the administration of the province of Babylon while Daniel was at the king's court. Okay, that's everything that we finished up 2 weeks ago. So we're going to shift gears here to chapter 3. I think before I read chapter 3, though, let's go ahead. We'll read the first 7 verses here, and then I've got some other stuff I want to work through first before we dig in. It'll take a little bit of time and maybe a little bit of your help because I'm going to go to the board here. So chapter 3, what happens in chapter 3? Someone yell it out. Okay, the king makes a great image, right? And wants people to what? Bow down. Okay. A few don't bow down, and so they get thrown where? Okay, in the fiery furnace of fiery affliction. Okay. So, chapter 3, verse 1, Nebuchadnezzar the king made an image of gold, the height of which was 60 cubits and its width 6 cubits. He set up on the plain of Dura in the province of Babylon. Then Nebuchadnezzar the king sent word to assemble the satraps, prefects, governors, counselors, treasurers, the judges, the magistrates, and all the rulers of the provinces to come to the dedication of the image that Nebuchadnezzar the king had set up. Then the satraps, prefects, and the governors, the counselors, treasurers, judges, the magistrates, all the rulers of the provinces were assembled for the dedication of the image that Nebuchadnezzar the king had set up. And they stood before the image that Nebuchadnezzar had set up. Again, I'm not digging into this here for a second. I'm going to throw this out there for you to chew on and get back to me later. It looks to me like only the ruling class is invited. That'll be important later. Then the herald loudly proclaimed, "To you the command is given, O peoples, nations, and men of every language, that at the moment you hear the sound of the horn, flute, lyre, trigon, psaltery, bagpipe, and all kinds of music, you are to fall down and worship the golden image that Nebuchadnezzar the king has set up. But whoever does not fall down and worship shall immediately be cast into the midst of a furnace of blazing fire." Therefore, at that time, when all the peoples heard the sound of the horn, flute, lyre, trigon, psaltery, bagpipe, and all kinds of music, all the peoples, nations, and men of every language fell down and worshiped the golden image that Nebuchadnezzar had set up. So many thoughts. The government is saying bow down to my religion, right? Okay. Now, let's pause here for a second. Remind ourselves. So Daniel's going to serve under 3 kings, kind of a fourth, during the span of 2 different rules of 2 different nations. Okay, we've gone over this. I want to remind us of it because I want to show us something else. So initially, it's the Babylonian Empire, first under the rule of, I'm just going to call him Nebu, okay? Nebuchadnezzar, and then the next guy is Belshazzar, right? And then at the end of Belshazzar's reign, the Babylonian Empire comes to an end. And then the Medo-Persian Empire begins its rule. I really hope you can see this. I just noticed this marker isn't happy. The first Medo king was who? Starts with a D. Kate? Yep. And then the Persian king was... Okay. So what I had originally showed us was Daniel's not... when you read it straight through, it's not chronological, right? But we're going to go through it chronologically. I've explained why. So to do that, we go through the first 4 chapters, which are primarily focused on Nebuchadnezzar's rule as under Babylon. Then we're going to jump forward to chapters 7 and 8, Okay? Then we'll hit chapter 5. After chapter 5, right, that's where the Babylonian Empire ends. Okay? And then the Medo-Persian Empire begins. So that's going to take us on. And this split isn't perfect. I'm just, okay, you'll understand it when we go through it. Okay? So we've got, basically the way I told you to remember it is just take the 7 and 8 out of order, plug it in over here, and then everything else numerically goes in the right order. So 6, 7, 8, chapter 9, and then 10 on. Okay? So here's why I bring this up, and I'll come back to the board here in a second. This is how that orange is even harder to see, isn't it? Yeah, okay. I wouldn't have minded if you had said something. It's okay. Okay, 6, let's say 9, and then to the end, just need 12. Thank you. I did that last time, didn't I? Thank you. Okay. Now, it makes sense to go through it this way, and I've already talked about that. Now, when you go through Daniel this way, chronologically, you do miss a cool theme that takes place in the book of Daniel. Okay? So we've got in chapter 1, we meet Daniel and the gang. And then in chapter 2, we get the dream of the statue, right? So what I want you guys to see is that chapters 2... So I got to do it this way. Okay. Chapters 2 and 7 go together. All right? So we're not all the way up there yet. But chapters 2 and 7 go together. If you actually peek ahead to chapter 7 here... What does your, and I'm really curious, what does the chapter heading above chapter 7 say? The vision of the four beasts. So, how many world empires were there? Four. How many beasts are there? These are the same. Okay, and we'll go through that. All right? What I'm showing you is in the middle of this, and I believe this is... God has done it. Yeah, I mean, do you ever read the Bible and just wish, boy, God, it would have been a lot easier if you had just written this thing chronologically? You realize he does that he had it laid out that way for a reason, right? It's actually really cool if you look at the way the Old Testament's laid out, because you get the five books of the law, right? And there's a pattern there, because then you get the 12 books of history, right? And then you get the five books of wisdom. Then you get the five major prophets and then the 12 minor prophets. So there's pattern in the way that God has constructed the Bible. And I believe that there's a reason why he has given us the information he has in Daniel in the way that he has. Because the themes of chapter 3 and 6 connect, and the themes of chapter 4 and 5 connect. Now, I really want us to think about this. So, and I devoted, you know, a chunk of class to it. Feel free to look ahead at your chapter titles. Let's see if we can figure this out together. Okay? Chapters 2 and 7 are related to each other. They are the introduction of world power. Okay? One in the form of a statue, the other in the form of beasts. And the cool thing is when you take chapter 2 and chapter 7 and put it together, largely chapter 7, you get a composite sketch of the beast in the book of Revelation. Yes? That beast in the book of Revelation symbolizes world power. Okay? And what is... Now, there's three beasts. So, how about the one that looks like a lion but speaks like a dragon, right? What does that beast in the book of Revelation represent? So, what did I say? A lamb that speaks like a dragon. What did I say? Oh, no. Lamb. Okay, the lamb that speaks like a dragon, what does he represent? He straight up tells you in the book of Revelation. He's the false prophet. And what does the book of Revelation say when it introduces the lamb that speaks like a dragon? It says it's his job to make sure that the people, what? Worship the beast and its image. So you have this beast, right, who represents world power. Does Nebuchadnezzar represent world power? Has he erected a mighty statue? That's probably of Baal, but isn't Nebuchadnezzar the likeness of Baal among the people? And is it fair to say that maybe the statue was probably inspired from chapter 2? Fair to say, right? Where he is the head of gold, right? He probably liked that part. So now you have world power statue saying, bow down before my God. Do you see how this is? You see why you have to study Daniel before you can study the book of Revelation? Okay? Now, chapters 2 and 7 are the introduction of those world powers. Together, they're a composite sketch of the beast in Revelation, which has the world, through religion, bowing down to it. Okay? In the middle, there's four narratives that play out in pairs. The first pair is chapter 3 and chapter 6. What happens in chapter 3? We already said it. People who refuse to bow down are thrown into the furnace. What happens in chapter 6? You can go to chapter 6 and look at your title headings. What happens in chapter 6? I know some of you guys know, you're just not saying. Chapter 6? Why is Daniel thrown in the lion's den? Yeah, because he refuses to be forced not to worship his God. So you've got people's faith and their allegiance to God being tested, right? Being found faithful, thrown into a furnace or thrown into a lion's den, and then God coming and protecting his faithful. Pretty cool, huh? Now, what happens in chapter 4? See, you can never forget this because, well, I guess you would have had to have seen the play that Sue wrote. But she did Daniel, and she did I believe it was titled From King to Quadruped and Back Again. And a quadruped means a four-walking, okay, four-legged, right? So in chapter 4, Nebuchadnezzar is forced down to four legs, right? So that's when Mr. Nebi becomes an animal and starts drooling all over himself and eating grass, okay? Why does God do that to Nebuchadnezzar? He humbles him. Because the world power has gone to his head and now he's taking it on his own. You read chapter 4 there on into chapter 5, pretty arrogant, the king. Okay, now, what happens in chapter 5? I'm going to recap all of this again. Hopefully the picture is helping. What happens in chapter 5? The writing on the wall, Belshazzar's feast. What happens at the end of chapter 5 to Belshazzar and, let's say, the entire kingdom of Babylon? It gets destroyed. Now, why does God... So God humbles Nebuchadnezzar in chapter 4, right? What clues are we given in chapter 5 for why God humbles Belshazzar? He's so filled with arrogance that in the middle of his party that he's throwing, he goes and gets the gold implements of the temple and brings them out so they can drink wine out of them in full mockery to the God of Israel. So God says, okay. And he lets an inferior nation, chapter 2 said, right? And he lets an inferior nation that if Babylon hadn't been resting on its laurels, drinking wine out of gold vessels out of the temple, probably could have defeated itself, protected itself. The inferior nation comes, wipes them out. Okay, so I hope this helps. This is the way I have it in my head. You've got your bookends here, chapters 2 and 7. Numerically are your bookends, and they are the introduction of world power through its false religion. Okay? Its idol worship pushed through its government. In the middle, there's two really important themes here. Okay? God, faith, God rescues and protects his faithful. Okay? And God will humble the arrogant oppressor. He will. Okay? So, I don't think if you go through it the way we're going to go through it, you'll necessarily come out to this major theme, and I believe it's there for a reason. And so I wanted to make sure to bring that out. Any thoughts, comments, questions on any of this? Hopefully you're just not flat out confused. Two major themes, right? You guys, help me out here. All I'm showing you is if you go numerically through Daniel, there's two major themes. What's one of them? This is good. Two major themes. What's one of them? In chapter 3, men refuse to worship an idol, and they're willing to be thrown in the furnace. And in chapter 6, this is all the same. This is a pair. In chapter 6, Daniel refuses to not pray to God. And he's thrown in the lion's den, and God does what? He rescues, he delivers the faithful. Okay? Are we the faithful? If we remain faithful to the end, what can man do to us? Right? God will deliver. He will rescue. That's the first major theme. The second major theme comes from chapters 4 and 5. What happens in 4 and 5? Yeah. World powers, those statues, the heads of gold, the ones who are taking the glory, God's going to humble the arrogant and the proud. I mean, you ever read Psalms and Proverbs? I mean, God opposes the proud. He will humble the arrogant. Okay? So, this is really important because Revelation teaches us that the world powers today are working. And they work through their channels. They work through that lamb. And they work through the harlot. Okay? Through world seduction and desires and achievement and through false religion, which really it's kind of just hedonism now wrapped in humanism, but that's how it's working. And it's requiring submission of every person in the world. But you are the group that's not kneeling down before the statue. You are the group that's saying, nope, I don't care what the government passes for laws. We will assemble and we will pray to our God and we will read our Bibles and we will talk about Jesus. You are that group. And there's a pretty good chance there's a lion's den waiting for you. However that looks, right? It could just be, it could be something simple, like you're no longer allowed to shop at Albertsons, right? Because you made a scene. And now food, you know, it's like how, I mean, can of worms, but it's interesting if you just study communism and how it ends at the end, how they get the people to turn on each other. It's like, you don't know how that lion's den's coming to you, but it's coming to you. But will God deliver? Okay, that's a pretty important lesson and theme from Daniel, huh? Okay, and I believe maybe you miss it if you go through it the way we're going to go through it. Really wanted to make sure that we hit that. So, okay. Daniel chapter 3. Let's start working through here. This is the first thing that jumps out to me. Verse 1. Nebuchadnezzar made an image of gold, 60 cubits high, 6 cubits breadth. And he sets it up in the plain of Dura in the province of Babylon and says, worship my God. I think if you read on in Daniel, well, I'll wait on that. But wait a second. How did chapter 2 end? Doesn't Nebuchadnezzar confess that the God of the Hebrews is God of gods? Apparently, that confession didn't prevent him from still being an idol worshiper. Here's the question. Why? I think the answer to this is important. Why? Now, maybe there's a little bit of a clue here in verse 47 of the previous chapter, right? The king answers Daniel and says, surely your God is God of gods. That's the problem. Yeah. 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 That's the problem. Look, the idol worshiping pagan nations all believed every nation had its own gods. But it also believed in the gods of the other nations. What's the first thing Jericho says? The God of the Israelites did that thing to the Egyptians. We have our gods, but that... Okay, so what we notice here is your God is a God of gods. That's the problem. So, you know, maybe let's look at, you know, you got third place, you know, first place, second place, you know, at the Olympics, right? You know, maybe God, you know, gets upgraded from, you know, third to second place. You know, or maybe even better yet, you know, maybe when Nebuchadnezzar said it, God, you know, he gets moved up to first place. Yeah. But the problem is Nebuchadnezzar still believes that there's a second, third, a fourth, a fifth, 99th, 100th, 1,000th, 10,000, right? I mean, however many gods there are, right? So the key word there being a god. The ancients believed that each nation had its own god. The Jewish religion, the Jews, God's people, were the only exclusive one that claimed all homage to Jehovah as the one true God. And I just wanted to bring that out. It has always been that way, and it is still that way today. Look at all the false religions in the world. And they're all saying, our God, our God, our God, but okay, your God, your God, your God. Now, in their mind, our God number one, your God number two. But they still believe that there is God number two. Guys, it is unique in the Old Testament through the law, and it is unique in the New Covenant and Christianity. The only group of people saying there is no other gods. There is one. That is unique to Christianity. Okay? Can you see why Christianity is so heavily persecuted in the world? Because Christianity is the only one to its fullness that makes that stance. Our God is God, and there is no others. That's why Christianity comes into the target of the world. And you can see how Satan's working here, right? Satan's like, well, any God, but the real true God is fine with Satan. Right? Doesn't matter. Even if it's idolatry or greed, Satan really likes that one. Greed, that's a good one for people to worship. As, you know, but as long as it's not the one true God, he doesn't care. Okay? So you can see why Christianity is persecuted. So, in case you haven't noticed that, you read the end of chapter 2 and you're like filled with this hope that we've converted Nebuchadnezzar, man. Like, no, the problem is, okay, the idol worshiper can't put the other gods aside, and it's a unique characteristic of Christianity.
This point is illustrated in the New Testament when Paul goes into Philippi and there's the woman that is the young lady that is possessed with the spirit of Python, and that's as the scripture would technically translate it, and she says, she's following them around and saying, they are declaring to you a way of salvation. Unfortunately, most translations will say the way, but it's a huge difference and a huge point in understanding that particular passage, because if, you know, it makes you wonder, well, why would this spirit, this demonic spirit, be saying these guys are preaching you the way of salvation? Because that's not what he said. He said a, and the whole idea, again, is to try to homogenize all of this so that we can have one universal set of control.
Yeah. Right, and if you're not familiar with the story, and then, okay, so why would this spirit say this? You're like, okay, and then why would the apostle rebuke it? Right? Because we all run around, and we're like, anytime somebody gets on NBC and runs and wins the 100-meter dash, and then they say, well, first I want to give glory to God, we're like, woo! And we don't even know if they're a Christian. But we're just thankful that they gave glory to God and not themselves. So you got this spirit running around saying, these men are proclaiming a way of salvation. It's like, oh, yay! But then the Spirit-inspired apostle rebukes her. Why? Because A and the, there's no room for, okay, your gods, they're just number two. There are no other gods. Okay, so you can see how Satan's been running the same algorithm on repeat for, because it works, right? Now, I would say under the new covenant, he's masked it a little differently on the outside, but it's the same code that's running in the background. Okay, because it, look, Satan understands he's been working on the heart of man, you know, from the very beginning. From Adam and Eve, to Cain, to Job. I mean, he'd been working, right? So Nebuchadnezzar makes this image of gold 60 cubits tall, 6 cubits wide, sets it up in the plains of Dura. Okay, the plain of Dura, what is that? Well, it's the only place it's mentioned in the Bible. Geographically, they kind of think they have it kind of figured out. It would have been north of the main city here. Doesn't matter. What can we figure out from the fact that, because most of these idols were in the city. Like when they excavate, an archaeologist and anthropologist go in, they find a lot of these in the city. This one's outside of town in a plain. Why? It's massive. What do you think of when you think of a plain? Yeah, I think of like the plains in America that are flat and there's lots of room for lots of cattle, right? It's just flat and wide and you can just fill herd grazing animals as far as the eye can see. So why does he build a statue in an area that's like that? There's lots of room for the people to come by the tens and probably hundreds of thousands, right? So they can bow down before this. So that's, you know, that's in there. That's all we know about, you know, Dura, but that's why he builds it there. So then here's the other thing we'll end on that I'll kind of give you, and you guys think about. This thing's 60 cubits tall. It's pretty tall, okay? Now we measure things in feet. Still trying to figure out how that happened. I looked it up one time. There was a reason for it, but how tall is that in feet? 90 feet. So you a cubit is about 18 inches, right? Now look, the Egyptians used cubits when they built the pyramids, but the Egyptian cubit is different than the Hebrew cubit. Okay, an 18-inch cubit is considered to be a short cubit. Okay, the Egyptian cubits, you know, round figures, 20 and a half inches. But I think the main idea for the cubit was it was the measurement from the elbow to the and again, every culture did it differently because some went to the wrist, some went to the hand, some went to where the fingers began, which is why you could get an 18-inch cubit or a 21-inch cubit. You know, my cubit significantly, you know, shorter than probably Larry's cubit. You know, and then you see some of these, you know, 15-year-olds that, you know, come out and their arms are hanging down to their kneecaps, you know, and those ones go on to play basketball. And okay, so I always just multiply by 1.5 because 18 inches is the length of a foot plus another 50% more. Math. Just whenever you see cubit in the Bible, multiply by 1.5. And look, if you've ever been to the Ark exhibit or done any kind of stuff like this, you've figured all this out. So 90 feet tall, okay? You guys ever seen that statue outside Butte? It's like, yeah, the idol outside Butte. Is it the mother of the Rockies or lady? Okay, lady of the Rockies. You, raise your hand if you've seen that statue off the highway. Okay, guess how tall that is? 90 feet. So there you go. That's how big this statue was. Now, it's kind of hard from the highway to kind of really judge, you know, what 90 feet looks like if you were standing there. But y'all know how big it looks on the side of the mountain when you're driving by. That is exactly 90 feet tall. So you get an idea for how tall this thing was. Okay? Now, its width was 6 cubits times 1.5. What is it? Quick, go. 9. Doesn't that bug you? 9 feet is about from here to Gerald's foot. And I know that because I played basketball and the hoop's 10 feet tall and I do like to golf. I know what a 10-foot putt looks like. Okay? This is about a 9-footer. Okay? 1, 2, 3. 9 and a half feet. Right there. Okay. So this thing goes 90 feet tall and it's this wide. It's kind of skinny. It's like a toothpick. The thing that makes sense to me is that the statue, because they didn't make the thing look disproportionate or ugly, it was their God, right? And breadth and width are sort of the same thing. A lot of translations say breadth, but that would be its distance from its chest to its back or its backside. Because they're trying to show you how massive it was, its size. And that its width, you know, probably would have been proportionate to its height. You know, if we took those ratios and applied them to a human, I mean, you wouldn't be alive. Okay, that's too narrow. So my guess is here is that the actual like span of the shoulders probably would have been proportional to the 90-foot height, and then that breadth that's mentioned there being 9 feet is just how, you know, how much depth there was from the front to the back. So we're at the top of the hour. That's a great place to stop. We got through verse 1 here, set up a lot of good things, and we'll keep going through chapter 3 here next week. So thanks for your attention, guys.